Not even the casual reader can miss the almost desperate attempts by the U.S. authorities to destroy the arms inspection before it's properly begun.
They're not concerned about the reality of weapons of mass destruction. They're concerned about playing gotcha.
I'm astonished that this happened because I've spoken at a lot of teach-ins in public schools around the state here in Wisconsin without ever having a microphone being taken away from me.
Most of the liberation movements that we have had in the 20th century have been on the back of students. Point is, you have to get out there and confront power. And that's what this war is about, because we all will be embroiled in it.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Thursday, December 5th, 2002. I'm Verna Avery Brown. One week into their work, the UN weapons inspection team has come under verbal attack by both Washington and Baghdad. There's growing concern in Baghdad that once again the UN inspection team may be infiltrated by CIA and British spies, collecting intelligence to lay the groundwork for an attack by the U.S. and Britain. According to Reuters News Service, Iraq has already branded UN arms experts as spies, although the U.S. and Britain have never admitted to any improprieties during the previous years of inspections. Iraq Ambassador Mohammed al-Duri asserts that there were indeed spies in the UN inspections when they were withdrawn in 1998.
We wanted that those inspectors working in good faith, in a neutral way, as international civil servant with integrity. And, we have a very bad experience with ANSCOM team because it was discovered that very well known now, even by Scott Ritter, told the international public opinion, and he told everybody through the media, through television, that there were spies there. American one, British. This became a very well known issue by the United Nations. Mr. Blix assured us, and Al Baraj assured us, that that would not be the case right now. We will behave as a civil servant without belonging to any other state, and we will work as a technician, not as spies, not as a politician within these inspectors' team.
Ambassador al-Duri also told Peace Watch that Iraq has no weapons of mass destruction and will continue to work with the UN arms experts.
Do you know something that very rare people know it, that Iraq itself indicates two inspectors where these, especially mass destruction weapons, chemical destruction were. So the inspectors didn't discover anything in Iraq. Iraq itself wanted to really to get rid from these weapons. And he told those inspectors where these weapons stockpiles. So now we know exactly that we have nothing to hide.
Ambassador Mohammed al-Duri addressing concerns regarding Iraq's cooperation with UN weapons inspectors in a previous Peace Watch interview. Phyllis Bennis is a UN analyst and a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington. We spoke with her about the UN weapons inspections team.
Well, the results that the inspectors have gotten so far has been quite positive. They've gotten, from what we're told, pretty full cooperation from the Iraqis. They've had access to every place they wanted to go, including one of the most lavish of Saddam Hussein's palaces. They've found what they expected to find. In the one case, when they found some old canisters, including mustard gas, it was what they had known from before. They had been informed by the Iraqis in earlier reports that the mustard gas existed, so it was exactly what was anticipated, despite the headlines in the New York Post today indicating Saddam has gas, as if it was something sort of new and frightening, which is, of course, what the New York Post is generally trying to persuade people of. But they've actually been quite successful in opening up the first week of inspections. Clearly, the first week's work was designed to go to what we might say are the easy places, the inspection sites where they were not anticipating significant opposition and where they had been before. These were not new sites.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we should keep in mind that part of the reason they were going to existing sites from the past rather than new sites is that the U.S., which claims to have the intelligence information indicating what the new sites might be and where they are, has refused consistently to make that material available to the weapons inspectors.
But we've heard just as recently as yesterday the Bush administration saying that they have this evidence and they wouldn't be making such precise claims if they didn't.
Well, the problem is, one, they're asking us to accept that on faith. And I don't think people have a whole lot of faith in this administration necessarily telling the truth all the time. Two, if they were serious, if they were really concerned about weapons of mass destruction, it seems to me the first thing they would do is provide that material to the weapons inspectors so they can go and find out, confirm it, or deny it. The fact that they're withholding that information means they're not concerned about the reality of weapons of mass destruction. They're concerned about playing gotcha. They're waiting for the inspectors to miss one of the sites, and then they'll go back and say, aha, you see, you didn't find it all. So if they want to play games, this is Washington playing games, this is unacceptable.
There are also some reports claiming that by the Iraqis that there are British and American spies on the UN team.
Well, I haven't seen any evidence of that. There are Americans and Brits on the team. The difference between the current inspection team and the earlier one, UNSCOM, which did include U.S. and British spies who admitted later to providing information, intelligence information, to U.S. and British and Israeli intelligence agencies, was that those members of UNSCOM, the earlier inspection team, remained accountable to their own military or intelligence agencies. These inspectors, what's called UNMOVIC, this team is made up completely of U.N. employees. They're not paid by anybody else. They're not accountable to anyone else. Now, obviously, that's not an absolute guarantee against there being a spy on the team, but it does make it far less likely than was true the last time around.
If the Bush administration moves forward, as you suggested earlier, that they are playing really a game of gotcha, what would the timetable be for that?
Well, after the Iraqis present their inventory list, which will happen in perhaps as early as Saturday, certainly no later than Sunday, it's likely to take a week or two before the initial assessment is done of that inventory to determine whether it's full and whether it represents full disclosure as they're required. Assuming that it does, the Iraqi the next stage for UNMOVIC will be to go back to Iraq and engage in the final verification process, which could take as much as a year. Now, that's all assuming that the U.S. allows that process to go forward. In my view, the threat of war in Iraq by the United States has little or nothing to do with what the inspectors find or don't find and what the Iraqis include or don't include on the inventory list. It's a politically driven decision, and I think they could be prepared to make that decision as early as later this month.
So we could be looking at a Christmas attack, perhaps, on Iran?
It's not inconceivable. I think it's less likely than an attack in late January, but certainly we now have Henry Kissinger back in the picture, the architect of the Christmas bombing of North Vietnam in 1972. Maybe this is something that he's looking at for 30 years later.
Mm-hmm. Phyllis Bennis is a UN analyst and a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C.
The Bush administration is facing a nightmare scenario.
Commentator Jeremy Brecher is author of A Nightmare to Love, How the Peace Movement Can Use Bush's Almost Desperate Attempts to Destroy the Arms Inspection.
Imagine that Iraq continues to let UN arms inspectors inspect without impediment. By the deadline for reporting on its weapons of mass destruction, the Iraqi government makes an extensive declaration of activities and materials that might be used to make such weapons, but also might have other purposes. The Iraqis then allow the inspectors to inspect all the sites they wish to enter. If the inspectors find some materials that might be used for weapons of mass destruction, they destroy them. The inspectors report to the Security Council. Then most countries, except the U.S. and perhaps Britain, declare that, whether or not Iraq once had weapons of mass destruction, it no longer does. Enforcement of sanctions begins to crumble, and world pressure to lift them builds. To prevent this scenario, the Bush administration is working frantically to discredit the inspection process. As former Assistant Secretary General of the UN, Hans von Sponeck, recently put it, no one, not even the casual reader, can miss the almost desperate attempts by the U.S. authorities to destroy the arms inspection before it's properly begun. Bush administration officials are smearing the inspectors. They are claiming the right to invade Iraq, whatever the UN does, and even to appoint a U.S. general to run the country after they conquer it. They are pre-positioning war materials in the region, engaging in a stealth mobilization of U.S. reserve troops, and bribing countries around the world to support their war in exchange for a share of the spoils of war. There is one problem with this strategy. The overwhelming majority of Americans, not to mention the peoples and governments of the rest of the world, want the inspection process to work. The almost desperate attempts by the U.S. authorities to destroy the arms inspection could boomerang if war opponents make an issue of them. Those desperate attempts provide us a golden opportunity to appeal to the American public. Peace advocates can lay out what the U.S. can and should do if it really wants inspections to work. Stop smearing the inspectors. Stop claiming that trivial inspection problems justify war. Stop military operations and provocative overflights against Iraq. Stop claiming that the U.S., not the Security Council, has a right to determine what's a violation. Recognize that the U.S. does not have the right to decide who will govern Iraq. Halt the movement of war materiel to the region. Stop mobilizing the reserves, something that many reservists and their families will welcome. Stop bribing other countries by promising a share in the spoils of war. Tell Congress and the American people of all offers made to other countries regarding oil rights, construction contracts, and any other valuable considerations offered in exchange for war support. Stop threatening to go to war over what Iraq does or doesn't put on a piece of paper. In sum, let the inspectors inspect. Laying out what is necessary to make the inspection process work provides a positive alternative to current policies. Equally important, it sets in relief all that the Bush administration is doing to ensure the inspector's failure. Kofi Annan recently observed that poll after poll showed Americans were eager for the president to act with the United Nations. Going to war on a flimsy pretext, Annan pointed out, would draw opposition not only from Security Council nations, but also from ordinary Americans who have expressed a desire for Mr. Bush to work with the United Nations in confronting Iraq. Bush administration attempts to destroy the arms inspection process give those ordinary Americans good reason for opposing the drive toward war. The anti-war movement should not ignore this gift. This is Jeremy Brecker for Pacifica's Peace Watch.
Jeremy Brecker is a Connecticut-based historian and the author of 12 books, including Globalization from Below. Support for a war in Iraq has emerged in unexpected quarters in New York, in the office of the president of the recently renamed New School University, a liberal college for social research and formed after the Red Scare of World War I by pacifists and academic dissidents from Columbia University. The current president of the New School is former Nebraska Senator Robert Kerry, whose support for U.S. military policy and involvement in a group advocating an invasion of Iraq has placed him at odds with students and faculty. Robert Knight from WBAI in New York has more.
For the past month, New School students have been protesting Kerry's fundraising links with military contractors and his membership in the Committee for the Liberation of Iraq, whose members have close ties with arms makers and Bush administration hawks such as Donald Rumsfeld, Richard Cheney, Richard Pearl, and Trent Lott. The committee's conservative coalition has advocated NATO expansion, increased military support of Israel, and the overthrow and economic restructuring of Iraq. After Kerry editorialized in favor of the committee's policy, New School students occupied his office on November 20th, demanding a debate. That debate was held in an overflow auditorium Wednesday, where Kerry defended his military approach to international affairs.
I assert, and I'll present evidence, that a military operation can accomplish a good thing. And indeed, as someone who voted against the first Gulf War in 1991, I watched in 1992 the United States unwilling to participate in a military operation in Cambodia. And though the United States didn't participate in that military effort provided the stability that allowed the Khmer Rouge to go out of business. And it did not happen simply because people of goodwill decided to live peacefully. Today, as a result of a NATO military operation, and the United States, in this case, participating in the peacekeeping operation, you can fly to Sarajevo and shop, That didn't happen because people of goodwill decided to live peacefully. It happened as a consequence of a military effort. Now, maybe some people in this audience believe that the Bosnia operation, the Kosovo operation, and others were a bad thing. I think they were good. Terrible things happened. Terrible things always happen in these kinds of military operations. I think it was a mistake for the United States of America not to get involved militarily in Rwanda. I would assert that we pulled out of Somalia too quickly after we got ambushed in the fall of 1993. We withdrew because we were afraid of further casualties. I'm not arguing that our war in Vietnam was morally correct or that we did a good thing there, that we didn't do terrible things in Central America, or that it's always been perfect. I'm simply saying, as I observe the world, that oftentimes it's not. There is a relationship between the capacity of people to live in peace and to live freely and to do what they want to do on their own as a result of the United States participating in military efforts. In Iraq, after the Gulf War, the United Nations passed a Security Council resolution authorizing a military force. And in many ways, the current debate about our Iraq policy is one that presents the audience with false choices, military operation or nothing. We have a military operation in place today. We have since 1991. And it has three very significant components, and we've lost Americans. Americans have died, and we've spent a great deal of money every single year. We have troops stationed in Saudi Arabia. We have troops stationed in Kuwait, and especially those troops in Saudi Arabia, because it's close to Mecca and Medina, have provoked significant opposition. The embargo on the waters of the Persian Gulf also are quite risky. The no-fly zones that were first flown by U.S., French, and British pilots, now just by U.S. and British pilots. If you haven't been to northern Iraq, or if you know nothing about northern Iraq, you should learn something. Because without those flights, there's an awful lot of Iraqi Kurds that would die. And we simply don't have the moral choice that lots of other nations do of quitting. Because if we stop that military operation, there are seven Republican Guard divisions in the north prepared to move in the moment we stop flying those missions.
Kerry's comments were challenged by New School student Colin Walsh.
President Kerry, it's my belief that your position on the Committee for the Liberation of Iraq is entirely inconsistent with the history of this university. Charles Beard and James Harvey Robinson, when they left Columbia out of protest for the stifling of free speech, specifically anti-war speech on that campus, and they came here to found this university, I think would be outraged by what's going on. Free speech has been entirely stifled on this campus. While you are taking a very public position, while you're writing editorials for the Washington Post and using the name of this university and representing this university to take a pro-war stance, speech is being stifled on this campus. The president of Veterans for Peace, David Klein, was canceled from speaking on this campus. Asif Ullah, the youth anti-militarism coordinator for the War Resisters League, was canceled. Howard Zinn was scheduled to speak this December. And through the bureaucratic processes of your administration, specifically the new policies of your administration that have just been implemented this summer, have barred Howard Zinn from speaking on our campus this December. You may claim that you have the right to freedom of speech, and I agree that you do. I just do not agree that that right includes dragging the name of my school through the press, backing this war. You seem to equate liberation and democracy with war. I disagree. I think that there are other ways. I think that the fact that the only method you see to obtain liberation and democracy as through war is narrow-minded. I think that there are other ways. And specifically, I think that the tradition of this university shows other ways. I think that the university in exile, which was founded at this school to provide a place for people who had to flee Europe, give a great example. If you're concerned about the liberation and the well-being of people in Iraq, why don't we found a university in exile at our school now for academics from Iraq? There are other ways. You've brought your ties to the defense industry, to this school. There is a new board of trustees member who is from Allied Signal, part of Honeywell Corporation. You are honoring George David, the CEO of United Technologies, in January at a fundraising dinner for this school. United Technologies being the company which makes Black Hawk helicopters and sells them to Israel. That is inappropriate for this school. These Black Hawk helicopters are killing people in Palestine in a terrible, terrible war there. It is unacceptable to me, it is unacceptable to many students, that you soil the good name of this institution to promote war.
Kerry's support for the military intelligence complex does not end with his pro-invasion stance in Iraq. In response to a question from Pacifica's Amy Goodman, he also supported inviting the CIA on campus for recruitment. Bill Hartung, a senior research fellow at the World Policy Institute based at the New School, sees a tragic irony in Kerry's pro-military leadership of a peace-based institution.
The Committee for the Liberation of Iraq is a private group made up of mostly former Republican officials, coordinated by a former vice president at Lockheed Martin, Bruce Jackson. And then they've got one prominent Democratic catch, so to speak, which is Bob Kerry, the president of the New School, former Democratic senator from Nebraska. And the purpose of this committee, apparently it was encouraged, the White House encouraged it to be formed and will be coordinating with it, was to try to win the battle for the hearts and minds of the American people to promote war in Iraq. The administration was apparently concerned that despite the fact that the Republicans did well in the elections, that Bush has been out stumping about war against Iraq for months now, public support has actually been dropping. More than 2-1, Americans are saying that they don't want a unilateral war in Iraq. Many are saying even if the inspections don't go smoothly, they don't see that as a cause for war. So really it's the impetus is the Bush administration trying to shore up its domestic support, and the significance of Kerry is that he's really their main Democratic supporter. And it's ironic, to put it mildly, that the president of the New School, a place that has been historically anti-war, which provided a refuge for exiles from Nazi Germany in the 30s, that's got a long progressive tradition, would be led by somebody who's willing to join hands with the Bush administration in this kind of propaganda venture.
Meanwhile, students and staff vowed to keep the heat on until Bob Kerry quits the Committee for the Liberation of Iraq or resigns as president of the New School. In New York, I'm Robert Knight.
The role and responsibility of students in today's society is crucial in these revolutionary times. That's according to Deborah Calhoun, the director of the American Friends Service Committee in Akron, Ohio. Calhoun shared her experience during an open forum against the war on Iraq at a recent Ohio State University Columbus event.
We are all diamonds in the rough, waiting to be steeled and tempered by the very revolutionary times that we live in. All of us are here today as a result of student struggle in some form or fashion within our own communities and with community at large. And I think we as students are very critical to how this plays out. I remember very many years ago when Bush the First implemented an invasion on Iraq in the middle of the night, 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. And I think that tells us what Bush Light may do this time. He will also move and do the same as his father has done under the cloak of darkness without anyone's real knowledge, move to hit Iraq. And I think that's what we can plan for in the coming days ahead. Students had organized talking about the war, and here I am 10 years later still talking about the war and still talking about students. But I think that says that we have an awesome responsibility. And when we step to humanity's intention to live the highest, we will be fulfilling one of the best things that we can have as humans and individuals to do, and that is to fight against injustice. Historically, students have always carried that burden. Anywhere you want to look in the world, whether it was my indigenous brother's struggle in 1973, daring in the face of the FBI and the CIA to challenge power, those were young men on the res who took arms up to raise issues of injustice. We know that all the folks we talk about, whether it's King, whether it's Gandhi, whether it's Kwame Nkrumah, whether it's Stokely Carmichael, also known as Kwame Ture, Martin Luther King, George Padmore, Jomo Kenyatta. Most of the liberation movements that we have had in the 20th century have been on the back of students. Now, I'm close to Kent State University. In fact, I've taught there for about 10 years in the Department of Pan-African Studies. And I remember raising the question to my students, what do you think students were thinking about on May 3rd, 1970? The black students had agreed and understood what power, when you confront it, is going to do to you. They left the campus on May 3rd. By hook, by crook, they said if you could not leave campus, stay low and stay away from the windows, because when the police move on this campus, they're going to shut down I-76, they're going to shut down the city of Kent and Route 59. And guess what? That's just what they did. And we know the rest of that story. Students who didn't even think, well, I have my parents behind me. I am white. I have privilege and I have power. That will protect me, but guess what? On May 4th, it didn't protect those who were four who were killed and those nine or so who were wounded and the others who were traumatized just even being in the area. In the 1960s, it was students, because at that time we understood that civil rights was confronting the humanity of every black male, female, and child in this country. When white students joined and went south for Freedom Summer in 64, it changed the paradigm, it changed the dynamic. It put focus and attention on it, because with those white students went, the cameras went with them. The media followed those students and saw what was happening, and we saw on our televisions the beatings, the dogs, the hoses. And it took students, and I'm saying to you, as students of privilege, because whether you know it or not, you have privilege, even though if you don't carry and use it. Let's use it to really make a difference. Let's use it to confront power. Let's use it to organize. And let it be protracted organization. And is it easy? No. You'll get more people who will hate on you than they will support and love you. But the point is, you have to get out there and confront power. And that's what this war is about, because we all will be embroiled in it, those who are of power and those who are not. If you're going to get beat down, it might as well be for something, because if you don't, you'll fall for anything. But as students, we have that awesome responsibility and potential to turn this. But I will say to you that what we do in this country has awesome power. It did in the 1960s. In fact, it sparked the Black Consciousness Movement in South Africa. And Mandela talks about in his memoirs of how he looked to the student struggle in the United States for his perseverance and his ability to live out for the long haul, surviving 28 years of prison. It sparked the Black Consciousness Movement in the Caribbean. And we know, because of the student struggle in the 1960s, it gave rise to the women's movement. It gave rise to the Gray Panthers, gay, lesbian, transgendered, people with different abilities. All these things came as a result of students hitting the streets. And I'm suggesting that the time is now to do it, because in those moments, right before the strike, is when we can expect the repression to happen. So I'm saying to us as students, now's the time to prepare, to study, to learn. Let's use this internet to our advantage. Let's organize study circles, because we need to study processes of change as they happen in other parts of the world, so that we know how to make change here. I think regime change begins at home.
Deborah Calhoun of the American Friends Services Committee addressing Ohio University students. That segment was produced by Reem Kathuda from WPFW in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. When we come back, a shock jock and an investigative journalist from Wisconsin clash over views on the war.
We are all diamonds.